Welcome back to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. His name is Paul Huddle. We're brought to you every Sunday night by RacePlace.com, Challenge Athletes Foundation, where we've raised over $65 million. Keep people in the game of life through sport. RunCatalina.com, Catalina Eco Marathon coming up in November. And you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. So, Huddle.
Yes, Bob.
Always a pleasure to have you back in studio. How long are you going to be in town?
Just here for another couple weeks and then back to Europe.
How hard has that been, moving to Europe? Has it not been
not as hard as I thought. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you don't think about when you're over here. You think everyone says, oh, it's going to be so hard. The hard part is obviously the language.
Yes.
And obviously that means everything you do becomes, you know, it's just everything, things take longer initially,
right.
Especially. So getting around, I mean, thank goodness for GPS.
Because, oh, my God.
Because I don't know how people got around in the old days without GPS.
How did they do it?
Exactly. You know, going to buy gas. It's sort of intimidating because, you got to go in and give them the money.
Liters.
Foreign currency, foreign everything.
Metric system, all that crap.
Yeah. And, you know, everything's a little different. The handle and, you know, I don't know. It's not a big deal, but it's when you're over there and you're alone and you're trying to get around and stuff, it just is a little awkward at times. Well, but the other part of it that you forget is, and this is, I think, what, you know, when it's hit me so hard this year. I feel like everyone should travel more because it really opens up your eyes to so many things about your own country. Not bad things, obviously, because you love your country. Yeah, good things. But you realize how American-centric you get.
Oh.
You know, and when you're over there, I haven't seen anything about baseball, basketball, football, anything.
And you've even missed it.
For 6 months.
Yeah.
It just doesn't exist.
Right.
And you think that's all that there is in the world. And there is. It's not.
Just
no one cares.
Soccer.
Trust me, the rest of the world does not care, and not that that's a good or bad thing. It's just it's very interesting to have that experience, and then it also, you know, when you see the news, for example, I know my mom's the best example. I think she watches Fox News 24/7. So when she heard I was going to, you know, whatever, I mean, I think there was an issue with terrorists
Turkey
in
or
Belgium
something.
Or whatever it was, and I was whatever driving through Belgium and Luxembourg and all these countries for work. And I told her about this. She goes, it's classic. But I just thought, a lot of America probably thinks like this. She goes, now, honey, I don't like that you're going through Belgium. I'm like, Mom, it's a freeway. You're like, it's like going through, you know, San Diego County. And she goes, well, did you see anyone from ISIS?
She did not.
She swear to God she did. But I thought, you know, if you're just watching Fox News all day long and you look at what's going on in the rest of the world, that's probably what your image is of the rest of the world. The rest of the world is not like that, you know. Then I was in France, and obviously they had the thing in France a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
You know, I happened to be there for Nice. Yeah. It was in Lyon. I mean, it's a big country, and same comment from my mom. Well, I heard that
ISIS is going to be erased.
I'm just
third
like,
transition
oh, my
area.
God. Anyway, so there's that. So it just – and then when you're over there and you see the news – it looks like the U.S. is everyone's just shooting each other. There's a mass shooting every other weekend. The police are just shooting
every black person
there is. And so it makes it look equally bad from that point of view.
You should be
so,
calling your mom going, hey, I heard some person got shot in,
in
the state of Illinois.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that perspective has been very interesting.
The other thing that's interesting to me is,
and by the way, a lot of people speak English elsewhere. You know,
that's
I mean?
The thing.
You just ask somebody, "I'm sorry, I don't speak your language. Do you speak it?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, what's up?
We
what
speak
do you need?
38 languages."
Exactly.
That's a thing that hit me when we were in Denmark, or I'm at Challenge Roth, or Ironman, wherever you're at.
Yeah,
we are losers.
We are complete losers.
We are complete losers because everybody speaks. You hear them speaking German. You hear them speaking Italian. Hear them speaking French and Spanish, and then you English. I can do that too.
Yeah,
it's oh my God,
it is really embarrassing because our entire office
None
in
of us.
Germany, everyone speaks English. They speak German, of course,
yes.
And then there's a huge percentage of them that also speak at least one other and sometimes two other languages.
That's
so
amazing.
It is amazing
because we grow up with un poquito español, right?
Si,
yeah,
si.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the one language I can understand more than I can speak, but at least I have a little bit of that. But I still feel like such a zero when it comes to languages.
Now, because cycling is such a big thing in Europe, do you find that more draft packs in the European races or not necessarily?
No, not necessarily. I mean, they're as adamant and as emotionally, you know, strong about non-drafting as we are. It's I think, narrow roads. I think, you know, the similar size races that we have here. I mean, it's an issue everywhere.
Right.
I will say that some of the courses, and not all of them, of course, Ironman Barcelona is a great example of this. 70.3, it doesn't matter if you want to draft. You can't. It's like you're going to climb 4,000 feet, and then you're going to descend some hairy descent.
Well, it sounds like Mallorca. All those things are like that.
Yeah, but the Ironman is very flat. It reminds me of Ironman Arizona. Mm. So drafting is going to be an issue whether, you know, no matter what.
If you're in the U.S., if you're
guess what? You go to Ironman Florida, drafting is going to be an issue. It's a flat course.
Right.
So, no, I don't think because that was my actual, that's what I used to think too. I'm like, well, they're used to cycling. Everyone drafts.
Yeah.
Not the case. I mean, there's the same amount of drafting over there that there is over here. I will say that in some countries, and this is the other thing a lot of people don't understand, is you have a different national federation who is enforcing the rules in every different country. Here you have one federation enforcing the rules across all of our events in the U.S.
Right.
So imagine if the rules, you had a different federation in Texas, a different federation in New York, different federation in Florida, different federation, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how
so
it is.
Everything's
over there.
a little
And there are different. Some different rules. I mean, Ironman did unify rules under ITU, and it's for the majority, 99% of it is the same. But then in each of these countries, in France is the best example, we have to what's the word I'm looking for? You have to give dispensation to the federation that you go by their rules.
Okay.
So they're going to stick with, you know, for the
majority of it.
They'll
use their own rules rather than your rules.
If there are rules they want to use that they're going to insist on, you have to do it because you're being sanctioned and insurance and all the rest of it under that.
That's everything's tied into that, right.
So the great example was, and it was such a ridiculous rule, it's ridiculous to us, but it does make some sense, is to check your bike in at a race in France,
yes,
Nice, Aix-en-Provence, you know, your bib number has to be attached in three places on your race number belt or on your, you know, jersey. So, you know, race number belts here have two places, right? Corner, and that's all you need.
Usually, you just have
over there. You
race
need,
number. You have
no.
Race
if you have belt. If you have a race number belt,
yes.
How many places are there to attach that bib number if the race number belt comes with those little?
I thought just
zip
one, like in the front, but I guess maybe two.
No, two
okay,
top
one,
corner, right?
Okay.
Each corner of the race number belt.
Okay.
Right. You have to have it on three. So we have to have safety pins there. Otherwise, the officials are not going to let you check in because it has to be attached in three places.
Isn't that funny?
But little rules like that no one would think of. You
sure.
Know, but so there's a lot of that. And some races, Barcelona, we had 50 officials on motos. We had 255 penalties. We had 25 disqualifications. You know what I mean? So they're on it. They're not.
Right.
Trust me, you're not going to get away with it. You know, you think, I'm going to go to Europe and just draft. Well, good luck.
That is wild.
Yeah. So anyway, so what about you, Babbitt? You got to interview me a little bit. I want to ask you a couple questions because, I mean, I think the biggest question that I've seen regarding you is your parting with competitor.
Ooh.
And a lot of people don't get this. A lot of people, I've seen some of the commentary about Babbittville and what you do and what you're doing now. And I know what's going on a little bit, but I don't think a lot of people do. So you need to give me the history of competitor.
Ooh.
Because those that don't know, there's we're so old now that there are people who go, oh yeah, he worked for competitor group.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I'm like, well, goes back a little further than that.
So
a little history on competitor, how that led to competitor group, and how the radio show was the competitors, and now it's Babbittville. People do not understand what's happened.
Gotcha. So all goes back, when I first moved out here in 78. Right.
Holy, 78.
I know.
I mean, I wasn't even born then. I was.
Started doing little triathlons, Fiesta Island. Read the Ironman story in Sports Illustrated in 1979 when those 15 idiots doing the race, and it was, you know, 12 finishers in both 78 and 79. And my roommate at the time was a guy I met rock climbing named Ned Overend. And this goes back so far. Ned became world mountain bike champion, but mountain bikes hadn't been invented yet. So we're talking the earth was still
And what were
going.
You doing at this time, living in an apartment with Ned Overend, who at that time was a mechanic for
Suzuki, San Diego Suzuki. And he was working on these things called the Scrambler. It was basically a duck hunting tractor, right? When these guys would break down in the bind somewhere out in the middle of the marsh, they'd call Ned to go fix their tractor.
What a great job.
And go kill ducks. And so that was what Ned was doing, and then I was working as a school teacher, a little a PE teacher at a private school in Sorrento Valley,
okay.
the children's school.
Yeah.
And our teacher, Lois Schwartz, who ended up becoming one of the best photographers in our sport. So we, I read that article in Sports Illustrated, and then 1980 went over and did the Ironman, and felt like, and had no idea, right? Had the bike with the police auction, a $70, $5 bike at the police auction, a pannier, sleeping bag, and tent on the bike, because I thought that you swam 2.4, rode 56, camped out, and rode back the next day. I didn't know you were supposed to do the whole Ironman thing in one day, which seemed really silly to me.
Which was kind of nice, though. Now you don't have to carry the sleeping bag.
Exactly, yeah. So anyways, ended up doing the race and finishing the race, which surprised me in one day. And I remember coming across the finish line and, you know, thinking there was going to be bands and there was going to be, you know, marching bands. There was going to be all sorts of excitement.
Announcer Mike Riley calling you.
You are an Ironman. Well, it was like there was a chalk line across the road. There was a light bulb hanging up, and this is in Oahu before it even moved to Kona, in Kapi'olani Park. And I come across this chalk line, and I hear a voice out to the side. It's like, "Hey, you!" I'm like, "Yeah, you in the race? Yeah, you're done." That was it, right? There was nobody there. There's one idiot doing one arm push ups in the park, and that was it. But I felt like
you didn't get a
no,
glass
nothing,
of water.
Nothing. In fact, we went over there. One of the reasons we went over there, we heard about these hole in the head trophies, right? These cool little Iron Man trophies that John Calvin.
Yes.
We got a seashell, right? We got
the seashell.
The seashell.
You still have it?
Sponsored by Nautilus. Yes. It was sponsored by Nautilus.
Yeah.
And so it was called the Nautilus Iron Man. They thought the term Iron Man was sexist. So they got rid of the term Ironman. It was called Nautilus Triathlon.
Now imagine all those people out there going, "Nautilus, what the hell is Nautilus?"
But
it was
a
fitness machine.
It was a fitness center.
And then those are the machines, the cam that you see on a lot of the machines, those are the guys that started that.
Even
Resistance, whatever that thing was. Anyway.
So anyways, did the event and felt like I had this, all of a sudden I had this business card that told me I could do anything, right? It sort of changed my perception of me. And felt that this event was really cool and would change. It changed my life and it would change other people's lives. So came back. There was a guy named Mike Plant who had a little magazine here called San Diego Track Club News. It became San Diego Running News. And I went to Mike and said, "Hey, I think the sport is really going to be big." And eventually changed the name to San Diego Running and Triathlon News.
What year is this? 80?
83, 84.
Yeah.
Right? And became Running and Triathlon News, and you know, I became LA editor. I left teaching, and Lois Schwartz became the photographer. Mike Plant taught her to shoot photos, and we would drive up every weekend to LA to cover these triathlons.
You weren't afraid a little bit, going, "How am I going to make money doing this?"
You didn't even think about it. Really didn't. I just loved it. Didn't think about it at all. So covering the Ironman, covering running, covering cycling, and just loving it. And then 87. The magazine went out of business. Running and Triathlon News was closed down. And, you know, Lois and I are like, "What are we going to do? This is our, you know, we don't have a livelihood anymore." So we went to meet with the owners of two cycling magazines in California. It was Southwest Cycling and California Bicyclists. I went to meet with both of them and said, "Listen, if we did a magazine that combined running, triathlon, and cycling and mountain biking, I think it could be really popular." And they're like, "You know what? Triathlon's a fad. It'll be gone in 5 years." This is 1987.
87, you already had USTS Triathlon Series. You had all this stuff.
We'll never put a skinny runner on the cover of the magazine. Cycling's the only sport we care about. So we're like, okay. I come back, and Larry White, who you know, and Ron Marola, and a guy named Joe Ellis came to us and said, "Here's a check for $17,000. Go start your own magazine." And we're like, "Wow. We're going to start our own magazine." We didn't know that 98% of all magazines go belly up. We knew nothing. We were a local race director let us rent space from him for $200 a month for 200 square feet under 20,000 pounds of bike racks. And that was it. You know, so we came out with the magazine. Running and Triathlon News went out of business after April of 87. And our first issue of Competitor was June of 87. And I remember calling the agency for Nike. Nike had been an advertiser at Running and Triathlon News. I remember calling him and going, "Listen, I'm doing a new magazine. It's going to be called Competitor. I can't even send you an issue because I haven't done it yet, and I'd love your support." And sight unseen, Nike bought the back cover for 3 years.
Wow.
Sight unseen.
No way.
Yeah. And just
how much was that worth at that time?
oh my God, I think ads were like $1,500 each or something like that. We were doing about, I think, 9 or 10 issues a year.
Oh, so that that kept you alive.
Well, and it's funny because for the first, we didn't pay ourselves for the first year and a half, and I lived on friends' floors, just moved from house to house until people booted me.
Wait, you're still doing that?
I know. I had no clue what we were doing. And then, you know, but...
Did you have a sales team, or were you
well,
a sales team?
Well, our first, Charlie Graves was an agent for Mark Allen and Scott Molina, and he became a sales guy, and then hired a guy named John Smith, who I saw at handing out my competitor, a magazine called City Sports that was competing with us. And, you know, I went to every event.
Joel Thompson?
Joel was one of my first sales guys, yep, went on to become a doctor. But it was one of those things where we just believed in the sports, right? We believed in running, triathlon, cycling. We knew they changed lives. And, you know, we it was just ignorance is bliss. We didn't know that magazines go out of business. We didn't know that, you know, that you're supposed to have a business plan. And we had none of the above.
Meanwhile, there was Triathlete and Triathlon.
There was.
Right?
It was Triathlete magazine. There was Triathlon had started. I actually wrote in the first edition of Triathlon. That's funny. First edition of Triathlon magazine. It's myself, Sally Edwards, Mike Plant, Harold Johnson. I mean, a lot of guys who stayed in the sport for a long time were writing in that first edition. Dave Scott. So we, you know, we were covering triathlon. And, you know, what really helped us was covering the sport of triathlon and covering the Ironman specifically, because as a free publication, I had to try to change people's perceptions. We had a free magazine. And if you remember back in that era, free meant basically worth nothing, penny saver, right?
Yes.
Free meant
nothing,
right?
Yeah.
And we're competing with Runner's World. We're competing with subscription-based magazines to try to get national advertising. So had to change the way people thought about free. So my mentality was, okay, when you watch television, ABC, CBS, and NBC are free. Turn them on for free. If I'm getting ESPN, it's subscription. So they have a subscription model, but they're also selling advertising. The way ABC, CBS, and NBC work, we create great programming, and we sell advertising based on a lot of people watching this free programming.
Yeah.
Well, why can't we do that with a magazine?
Yeah.
So that was the idea, was we are going to create a great magazine with competitor. We're going to have great photography. We're going to have great editorial. We're going to have glossy. And we're going to sell advertising based on we are creating.
How are you going to distribute it? How are you going to decide how many?
Where we're going to be free. But one of the things that we did early on was running stores, bike shops, municipal pools. Those are sort of your low-hanging fruit. Those are places you're going to be. But how often does Paul Huddle go into a bike shop, right? Maybe once a month, maybe.
Yeah,
running store every 3-4. So if I'm doing 12 issues a year, you're missing 3, 4, or 5 of my issues. So are you going to be a committed competitor reader? So I wanted something that where people could see us, one, have a visible location, and two, have a place that people go on a regular basis. So did deals with Rubio's. Right.
Rubio's Fish
and,
Tacos. Yeah.
And with Jamba Juice.
Yeah.
And my mentality was that I felt that as Competitor Magazine, we had an obligation to grow our sports. And our obligation started with, if Paul Huddle's a race director, as soon as your race is over, your corral's empty for next year. How do you fill it up? New people. How do we get new people? If I'm just distributing in running store and bike shop, I'm speaking to the committed. How am I getting new people?
Yeah.
So the person who's going to Jamba Juice is usually somebody who's saying, hey,
trying to
listen,
do something healthy.
Instead of having a Whopper for lunch, I'm going to have a smoothie.
Yeah.
And while they're there, they see competitor and they see a 5K. And once you put a number on, you're hooked.
Yeah.
You're part of our world. And that's how you grow the sport. And that was the whole mentality behind those locations. Plus, in 1990, went to XX, 1090, it was 690 at the time. The Mighty 690.
What year was this?
1990. Went to them and said, listen, I think our sports are special, running, triathlon, cycling, mountain biking, and I would like to purchase some time to have a show called The Competitors, because I felt that the brand was important. So I had Competitor Magazine, Competitor Radio, Competitor Awards. How do we make our sports bigger than life? We have to make our athletes bigger than life.
Yeah.
So if people listen to the Mighty 690 and on Sunday night hear an interview with Dave Scott and Mark Allen after hearing an
interview. Which, at night, on the 50,000-watt blowtorch.
Exactly. That, after listening to an interview earlier today with Wayne Gretzky and Magic Johnson, all of a sudden people were like, well, they must be important too. Because we're speaking to the uncommitted at that point. I'm trying to reach new people, where that was the whole idea of competitor. So over time, we grew competitor to 11 editions of a brand. We basically had an agreement with Windy City Sports in Chicago, Rocky Mountain Sports in Colorado, Metro Sports in New York and D.C., and then we purchased magazines in Florida that became competitor Florida, competitor Southeast, competitor Northwest.
So you took your circulation when you first started. What do you think that first run
was? We were 60,000. We grew up to 500,000. We grew from 60 to 500,000, and then we grew. Then we had the magazine, and the push and pull was, we're doing the interviews. You and I are doing the interviews with Lance Armstrong.
Amazing athletes. I can't believe the people that you got.
We've gotten really special athletes. And then we would take those interviews, transcribe them, and put them in Competitor Magazine.
Sure.
So it's like, let's use that content. And then, you know, when the web started, then you're putting that content on the web as
And also when you're selling ads, you can also tie
you
in the radio.
You can cross-pollinate.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a big thing. So when we started in 99... one of our clients at Brooks was, you know, we went to them to try to sell them advertising. And I remember their president, Bruce Pettit, saying, listen, we can't compete with Nike and Adidas and Reebok in terms of advertising, but we've got some dollars for promotions. Can you come up with a cool event that might make sense for us? Right? So that became Muddy Buddy. And Muddy Buddy,
you're
was
like, can I come up with an event? We've had an event going on for 20 years now, every
ride
on
time,
the holidays,
which was a goof, right? We did goof. We had an event that was called Ride and Tie, and it was in Penasquitas Canyon. And the whole idea was
Easter
and Thanksgiving.
Oh, Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. So the whole idea was people were very fit after Ironman, but nobody wanted to do anything serious.
Yeah.
So Thanksgiving, it was two people, one mountain bike, no rules. Stuffed animals, you know, I had 300
stuffed animals for time bonuses.
Spam, Dr. Spam, we had Spam Station.
And at Thanksgiving, if you got the stuffed turkey, it was an extra, it was a huge bonus.
The turkeys, we had, you know, 10-minute turkeys out there, and those, you know, you brought back a turkey. So it was one of those things. It was yourself and Paula and Tinley and
you know,
Molina,
and you say and not serious, but
it was serious.
Serious bragging rights to win that thing.
I know, because we
it
had championship
brutal.
Belts
yes.
that Ben Boyd
made out of foil,
right?
Aluminum foil pants.
So it became, that became...
The Brooks Muddy Buddy.
That became the Brooks Muddy Buddy. What happened was Brooks won an event. I'm like, well, what if we took my Ride and Tie, which has no rules whatsoever, and maybe add some obstacles, add a mud pit, so you can, you know, so it's a leapfrog event, which basically leapfrog. So the frog became my costume of choice, and so it was you and I. I'd start out on the mountain bike, go about a mile, leave the bike at the obstacle.
The runner would pick up the bike.
The runner, I would do the obstacle, start running. The runner would run up to the obstacle, do the obstacle, grab the bike, ride by me, and leapfrog back and forth, finish up in a mud pit, and go have a beer. And it was, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, I remember one of the first races, I had a guy come up to me and go, dude, I had a weight at the inflatable. And, you know, I might have placed in my division. And I'm like, dude, I'm in a frog outfit. You know, the last time I checked, we're not in the Olympic program, right? Here, you want a medal? I got one in my pocket. Beer garden's over there. So it was one of those things where it just caught on. And so we were in a little bit of a quandary. I knew when we had 7 Muddy Buddies, that we had caught lightning in a bottle. The Muddy Buddy was very successful. Mm. And we had, you know, had the 11 editions competitor, had the radio show, had the endurance awards. But if we wanted to grow Muddy Buddy, and I felt that Muddy Buddy was one of those things that we needed to become big quick. Go from 7 to 13 to 18 quick, because somebody was going to come out there, some bigger company, could put 10, 12 events, and basically I become secondary immediately. So the options were, A, go get a huge loan, put our houses up, and because each, if adding a new Muddy Buddy was basically 6 figures every time you add an event. So we could add one a year. Mm-hmm. So it was either bring in a partner who could invest in our company and probably hose us, Two, go get a big loan and put our houses at risk. Or three, sell the company and create something bigger. And when Peter Engelhart from Outdoor Life Network, had been with Outdoor Life Network, was at a private equity firm called Falconhead, when he approached us and said, I want to put together media and events, under one umbrella, and I love the competitor brand, that's when we sold the private equity, and it became the competitor group. And there was
what year was that?
It was 98. Oh, I'm sorry. It was 2008.
2008.
It became the competitor group with Seven Rock and Rolls, with Triathlete Magazine, with Inside Communications, which was
Inside
Velo News,
Triathlon.
Inside Triathlon. Yep. It was Competitor Magazine, which you know encompassed Windy City and Rocky, and we became one big brand.
And they took your name. They called it Competitor Group.
They believed in the brand.
Yeah.
And it was cool. It was really interesting. Before I sold, I talked to my friend Jeffrey Esikow, who's my co-founder of Challenge Athletes Foundation.
Smart guy. We talked
about, you know, he sold his company, Tinling Company, to Reebok. And I asked him, you know, what I should be concerned about. He says, well, what's going to happen is someone's going to tell you that we believe in your vision and we're just going to give you money to pursue your vision. He says, nobody's doing that. What they believe is that you don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah.
And we're going to invest in this because you're undervalued and we're going to make it worth a lot more.
And
but not because we're going to boot you and we're going to go sell the thing for a lot more money. Because private equity is a 3 to 5 year growth. So from 2008 to 2012, you went from 7 Rock and Rolls to 34. Yeah, 32 or 34. Muddy Buddy went from 7 events to 13 to 18. And they created a Tri-Rock triathlon series.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had Triathlete Magazine, closed down Inside Triathlon, had Velo News, and started Women's Running Magazine, which had been very successful. And so it became a big company.
Yeah.
It became a pretty huge entity with, you know, a few hundred employees. And, you know, I had 22 employees at our top end.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the competitor group might have like 500. I mean,
must have been a bit of culture shock.
It was culture shock. It was culture shock. And it was things were just done a little differently. And, you know, when people say, well, so I was there till 2000 and a year ago, basically about exactly a year ago. And I've been there, you know, I started the brand in 27 years ago.
Yeah.
And just felt that to a certain degree, it had lost its way a little bit. I felt that, you know, Muddy Buddy was, you know, we put on the events only in markets where I had a competitor magazine to promote them. And that was really important to promote through our own brand.
Yeah.
And that went away. We started putting events on in Buffalo, New York, in places I couldn't promote the events from.
Yeah.
Missed the whole Facebook, Twitter thing.
Social media.
Being the oldest guy there, I was a huge proponent of that because these are social events.
Yeah.
But the powers that be at that time didn't believe in social media and didn't do social media. So it was pretty interesting at the time. And what happens is you get different levels of management and then you can't be nimble. When you're a small company, you can be nimble and do stuff.
Mm.
When you become a bigger company with, like I said, hundreds of employees and hundreds of events, and when you've got Rock and Roll, which is really your cash cow, are you really going to be that concerned about events that are out, you know, 2,000 people doing a Muddy Buddy out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Right. Rather than blocking off downtown Savannah, Georgia, or San Antonio, Texas, it's a different gig.
Yeah.
So to me, I felt like going off and creating my own, you know, creating Babbittville Radio, doing the Tripalooza, it allowed me to be me again. Because the other thing that really bothered me was the competitor brand represented running, triathlon, cycling, mountain biking, and the feeling was that competitor meant running, right? Because they had Velo News was a cycling magazine, Triathlete was the triathlon magazine. So competitors gonna be our running magazine. So we're gonna be the number one running magazine. Sort of going away from your roots, going away from 25 years of history as a magazine that brought new people in to brand new sports, right? We were there at the beginning of adventure racing, beginning of mountain biking.
Yeah, and I noticed the magazine itself, Competitor, stopped getting placed in Rubio's.
Yes.
They stopped doing a lot of the stuff you had.
Yeah, they sort of moved away from that, and the upper management was like, well, why would we be where people eat? I said, well, because that's where brand new people come from. And then the other one was they wanted to get rid of Jamba Juice. The head guy there was like, why are we in a place like Jamba Juice? I said, why don't you do me a favor? What's the zip code for Manhattan, right, where all the ad agencies is?
Yeah.
Okay. There was 12 Jamba Juices in that zip code.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's why we're there. Because when the guys who are making decisions are going to Jamba Juice, and they're picking up competitor. So fortunately, they kept the distribution in Jamba Juice, which is huge. The other thing that concerned me, if you think about it, the sport of triathlon, to a certain degree, I think we were somewhat instrumental in the growth of triathlon, because every year I did a pre-Ironman.
You were instrumental, Babbitt. Just clear that up real quick here.
Well, but the magazine.
Yeah, for sure.
What we did through the magazine with the showcasing
of our
athletes.
Absolutely.
And I felt, you know.
During sports awards.
All that.
Yeah.
And it was important to me to showcase that sport. I mean, one, think about the sponsors of Ironman back in the day. It was Timex. It was Gatorade. As a free magazine, we were never going to get on those ad lists, right? We weren't an audited magazine. We weren't going to get on, you know, with the agencies going to look at us and go, no. Well, Gatorade insisted that we were on the plan because we were a niche magazine in their niche sport that they were involved with. So we were getting national business that we would not have gotten if we weren't involved with Ironman. Actually, one of the turning points for me is when a major player at competitor said to me, when I was wearing a shirt with an Ironman logo on it, he said to me, when you wear a shirt with an Ironman logo on it here at competitor, you're basically, it's like somebody who works at Nike wearing ASICS shoes to work. And I'm like, wait a second. Do you have any idea how important the brand of Ironman was to the growth of this brand, you know, to the creation of, you know, for Triathlete magazine, for competitor, for our credibility over the years? So much of that was tied directly to the Ironman. So it made me realize that people didn't quite get it. And that's okay. You know, and one of the things that you have to understand, when you sell your brand, it's not your ball.
It's not yours anymore.
It's not your ball to make that decision. Yeah. So with Ironman, I just felt that competitor, by showcasing the sport of triathlon on the cover 3-4 times a year, it gave credibility to the sport, right? And to those athletes. And doing a runner on the cover every single month, the sport of triathlon, it's not on the cover of Men's Health. It's not on the cover of Men's Journal. It's not on the cover of Outside Magazine. What national magazine with a circa 500,000 is exposing the sport to help grow the sport and fill those corrals? None.
Yeah.
You know, competitor went away from that.
So
the competitor doesn't do cycling, doesn't do mountain biking, doesn't do triathlon, doesn't do obstacle racing. It's a running product. And that's okay, but that wasn't my vision. And, you know, I thought it was narrow. I thought it was short-sighted. And I think I can do more by going with the Babbittville title, and we're going to be doing a new radio show called the Endurance Sports Network that's going to be on.
I saw that. Congratulations!
Thank you.
So
that's
you're going to be on. How is it going to work now?
So iHeartRadio.
That's a great explanation on the whole competitor versus Babbittville thing. So when you decided to leave competitor, competitor was already not yours,
right?
So when you left.
Yeah, I was just an employee at that point.
Right.
I was
so the competitor radio show was basically theirs.
Right. It was a brand I created for them. Same with the competitor awards.
Right.
You know, and so those were their products. And so that's why I went and created Tripalooza. It's
right.
a brand new entity with an expo and awards. Right. And we had 400 people last year for a first time event.
Yeah.
And then we've had, you know, over 450,000 downloads of the Babbittville radio interviews, which has been really, really nice. People have been incredibly supportive.
So when a light bulb went off when you said that 500,000 circulation for triathlon and endurance sports. What is, it's gone away.
That's gone away.
So what is there out there right now?
Nothing.
On a national basis.
Nothing.
That represents us, that
nothing.
Represents triathlon.
That's what I mean. There really is nothing. I mean, Triathlete magazine is wonderful. Lava is wonderful, but they're small niche magazines.
How many do you think the circulation is on each of those?
I think they're both south of 100.
Yeah.
I think they're probably between 50 and 80,000 or something like that.
Is Windy City Sports still out there? Are those other publications that you guys partner?
Okay, so
that's all competitor.
Yeah,
now.
That became part of the competitor group and competitor. So, you know, the competitor, we would put a cover for Muddy Buddy leading into Muddy Buddy Chicago, right? And promote that. And the Chicago Triathlon, New York Triathlon, those were cover features, right?
Yeah.
Around those.
Yeah.
And we worked in conjunction with those events to create inserts in the magazine to promote those events.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the idea. So it's, you know, it's, again,
it's amazing to me that a school teacher decides that he wants to start a publication and goes from from that to what you ended up selling.
Well, thanks. It was really cool, and you know, and Lois was amazing. Just, you know, as my Lois was the best partner you can have, because we, you know, when I wrote a check to the same company three times within a week, we realized that I should stay away from the checkbook, and that she would handle that stuff and handle, you know, all the HR and all that type of stuff.
And remember when you built this and grew this was like a lot of this was very pre sort of what we all take for granted now in terms of how you produce a magazine.
Oh, totally.
You know what I mean? It's not like computers and layouts. I mean, it was all very manual. I think about some of that stuff, even on the Race Direction side. I'm just like, oh, my God, how did anybody do this?
You know what's amazing is when we produced the magazine, it was a three-day process to produce the magazine, and you ran out each page like you were printing a photo. You had processor and chemicals, and you had a whole room full of this stuff that could kill you. And so each time you ran out a page, it was like you ran this page out, you had to wax it and put it on basically on a page. And if you had a typo, you know, a correction, you had to use an X-Acto knife and cut out the word and paste in the other word. I mean, it was so hard. I couldn't believe the first time they said you're able to run a page out from a computer and it was on like a piece of typing paper. I'm like, there's no way that this quality is going to be the same. And it was.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God. It made, and then, you know, for years we never were able to run, you know, color photos.
Yeah.
We ran, you know, the one photo we could run was on the cover.
Yeah.
And then to be able to run color photos inside and color ads.
So now that you've done this, now that you've taken this leap, and this has been
pretty
a year.
Scary.
This has been a year. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that because we talk to athletes all the time who are at the end of their careers and have to move on. This must be unbelievably scary for someone who's been doing what you've been doing for 25 years and now.
It was really scary, and you know, it's like
it's your identity.
My identity was competitor. Yeah. You know, if I think about the brands, and I like to think that I'm pretty good at brands, so it's, you know, competitor, Muddy Buddy, Challenged Athletes Foundation, you know, those are the
65
you know,
million, by the way.
Yeah, $65 million crazy. Raised for Challenged Athletes Foundation. So the brand aspect of it is you know, like you're starting over again.
Yeah.
You're starting over with a gun with Babbittville and the Endurance Sports Network and Tripalooza. And you never know where it's going to go.
Right.
You know, you think about it, the guy who created Rollerblade, he sold Rollerblade, and the next thing he created was Robike. Whoever heard of that, right? Never went away. So it went, you don't know what's going to happen down the line. But I do believe the one thing it has not changed is the belief in our sports and the belief in our athletes and the belief in storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, our athletes are special. And the stories have not changed significantly since then. So,
I just heard I just heard our board op tell us we got 2 minutes, but I feel like this is easily another half hour conversation. But in all seriousness, I mean, now you've got Babbittville, now you've got Endurance Sports Radio,
Endurance Sports Network,
Endurance Sports Network, and Tripalooza, and who knows what the next 25 years is going to bring, Babbitt.
Oh my God!
No, but seriously, you're like the Energizer Bunny. Everybody who knows Babbitt knows they're going to see you at an event on a weekend, and just you're all over the place.
Well, and that's the cool part is you don't want to ever stop doing racing. I mean, that's the best thing is people need to know how cool this stuff is. This weekend I was at Spartan Race outside of Philly, or Allentown. And it reminds me of early triathlon.
Early days in triathlon,
I mean, you got guys with no shirts on, with the numbers on their chest, and people just love it. They just love being connected to, and, you know, and you can see the camaraderie. Yeah, they're competing with each other, but they're also, what I love is when they get to these walls and stuff,
they're
helping
each other out. Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, it's an individual sport, but there's a
huge group dynamic.
Yeah, teamwork involved.
Huddle. So you're going to be able to come back in?
Yeah, I think so. If not, certainly by the telephone at least next week. I don't know.
Okay,
we're thinking of heading up to Utah, and
as well you should.
Yes, and then I'm out of here on the 25th.
So no Leadville this year.
No Leadville this year, and it kills me. They just had Silver Rush today, and that's such an amazing event. Those guys do such a great job. And yeah, the Leadville is, as you know, the Kona of mountain biking.
So will you be in Kona?
I think I will, yeah. I'm trying to. Again, I'll be in, we've got Mallorca 2 weeks out, then Barcelona 1 week out, and then, as you know, it's like a 12-hour time difference.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, that was a nightmare last year a little bit. But then again, it's how can you not be there, right? That's where our whole family is.
Exactly.
That's where everybody who we know and love is. So, yeah, I hope to be there.
Paul Huddle has been our special guest in studio.
Paul Babbitt has been our guest.
Oh, yeah. We are brought to you by Babbittville.com. Check us out on iTunes as well. RacePlace.com, Challenge Athletes Foundation, Catalina Eco Marathon coming up. You can check that out at RunCatalina.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. See you next week.
Would you like to be part of the world's largest sporting event? Join the